How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.
Hello, hello, and welcome to How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast series with myself, Nadina Regan. In this series, we talk about leadership through talking to some great female leaders and hearing their stories. We also get advice from experts in areas such as networking, public speaking, and career management. Speaking of which, later on in this episode, I'll be joined by Sarah Geraghty of the Communications Clinic. She'll be discussing CV preparation, how to answer when you're asked what is your greatest weakness, and also how to help yourself when you're looking to get that job interview in the first place. But now I'm delighted to tell you that our first guests on this episode of How I Did It, coming to you from our studio space in the Dublin 2 home of our sponsored Glandor, are two women who are in very different ways dealing with one of the most challenging problems of our times, how to use technology as a force for good. Oanya Kerr is co-founder and COO of Kinzen, a technology company that identifies online misinformation. Kerr was previously manager of global journalism partnerships at Facebook, and before Facebook, she was managing editor of the news agency Storyful, which she also co-founded. She began her career in teaching and then journalism. Maureen Murray is co-founder of Tech for Good Dublin, which promotes the use of technology for positive social impact. The founder of Digital Doddle, an e-learning agency that produces online courses, Murray was previously a senior digital producer for the BBC. In the podcast you're about to hear, Oanya and Maureen speak about what they call squiggly careers, how sometimes you have to go back to go forwards. They also had a lot of interesting things to say about online misinformation, where we're at now, and how we need to better protect ourselves in the future. So, a lot of food for thought. Here is Oanya Kerr's and Maureen Murray's How I Did It.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Oanya and Maureen, you are both very welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being our guests.
Delighted to be here.
Now, Oanya, to start with you, you're coming to us over the phone line today owing to COVID, what can we say? It strikes again in the household. So unfortunate news for you, but thank you for taking the time. We really do appreciate it. And I suppose to start, can we talk a little bit about the situation in Ukraine as relates to misinformation? Because this is such a hot topic at the moment. People want to know that the news that they're getting, whether it's via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or indeed through traditional media, is reliable. So Kinzen obviously has a big role to play in this. Can you explain exactly how you operate?
Yeah, thank you. Well, really, this moment that we find ourselves, this information crisis, has been years, decades in the making. We're just still slowly emerging from a pandemic and, stuck at home again with the second case of COVID today. So it hasn't gone far away still in our lives. But we have been dealing with 2 years of a pandemic, and in direct parallel to that, a global infodemic, where people have had to really practice critical thinking when it has come to what they see online, when it comes to COVID, when they see information about vaccines. Now, part of the last 2 years has probably actually prepared people for this moment of wartime in Ukraine and seeing the invasion by Russian forces, that I think people have been taught a lot about news literacy, the critical questions that they need to ask when they see information, videos, memes, hashtags starting to go viral. And people now know what it is in this moment, I think, to be the wisdom in the crowd, that when you get that WhatsApp message or you see that thing on Telegram or you're doing the doom scrolling on Facebook, that I think increasingly people are having a moment of pause, they're calm, they're curious, they're asking critical questions before they decide to share, because we know an awful lot more about this wicked problem that is ultimately fake news, or what we would call misinformation and disinformation. And we see it again playing out with Russia, Ukraine today. Misinformation is often people mistakenly sharing something they believe to be true. And we know with all of the research now that when information is uncertain and anxiety is high, the natural response for people is to try and resolve that and uncertainty and anxiety by seeking out information. But sometimes that information is false and you've just been used in this misinformation phenomena. But of course, we're seeing disinformation, which is where it is calculated, it is created, and it is sown out there to deliberately spew confusion, in a massive historic moment like this. So where does Kinsan come in and all of that? We have set ourselves out really to empower the internet's essential workers. So we're like the support team, the trusted flaggers for people who are inside platforms trying to protect our online communities and keep them safe from harmful content. So we're working day to day with trust and safety teams inside some of the biggest platforms in the world, their content moderators, their policymakers, and just ensuring that using our blend of human expertise, we're working in about 15 languages around the world now. So using all of our boots on the ground, journalists, fact checkers, researchers, combined with machine learning techniques, that we can help ensure that these people inside the platforms are getting ahead and staying ahead of threats such as dangerous misinformation, organised disinformation and hateful content.
And Maureen, the events of the past few weeks, what are the thoughts going through your mind about areas like protection, misinformation, and the case for damage being done via sources emerging with information that simply isn't true?
Yeah, I mean, well, I suppose what struck me is that we are actually lucky that we can share information. Now, it may not always be correct and it may not always be factual. We may be sharing something that's not 100% true, but that is a privilege. Like at the moment, we have a huge privilege that we have access to all sorts of information from all sorts of sources, where what's happening, unfortunately, in Russia is that that information is being cut off. So like, I think Facebook is no longer accessible. Twitter is no longer accessible. I think there's talk about maybe YouTube being no longer accessible. I think Telegram is where a lot of the kind of information is shared from in terms of the Russian community and the Ukrainian community. So that is almost like a worse position, where there's almost like no information, where it's been completely cut off. There's no debate, there's no discussion. They're just getting one very simple narrative fed to them, and that's so dangerous and that's so frightening.
Mm. Yeah, well, it strikes me that in the 90s, what we had was this new collaborative era where, with the explosion of information through technology, people were sharing across networks in multiple countries and the possibilities were endless, and often actually particularly for women, because they were able to form networks and share stories in a way that they hadn't previously been able to do. But there is a concern now that we're going to enter a new period of isolationism where, you know, whole areas, whether it's Britain or Russia or China, will all pull back into themselves, understanding that they want to actually cut information sources rather than enhance their information sources. So maybe that's something that we can talk about a little bit later on. But before we do that, I want to get back to your background stories. And Maureen, you were a digital producer with the BBC in the mid-noughties. What particularly drives you from a work perspective?
It's very much about doing something that I personally believe in, that I will do even for free. Over the last number of years, I'm like, if I win the lottery, will I still want to do this? And will I do this for free? Do I believe in it to that extent? You know, the way people always say, oh, you've won the lottery and you give up your day job. I never want to be in that position, because I want to be doing something, whether it's paid or unpaid, that I 100% believe in. In terms of wanting to do it.
Anya, would you feel similarly?
Yeah, I've had something of a squiggly career. Yeah, I think I've always been driven by some sense of purpose. And I've spent a lot of time trying to think about, like, is that instinct? Is it gut? And I started to just call it my inner signal, for want of a better phrase. And I think I've known it since about the age of 15, when I had to sit down with a blank sheet of paper and I drew a head on one side and heart on the other. And under head, I wrote teacher, and heart was journalism. And I wrote out all the pros and cons. And I decided at age 15, I'm going to become a teacher first, and then I'm going to do journalism, get a great rounded degree, a vocation, great life experience that would inform my journalism and give me a real cause. And that is what has happened. And it's only now I've understood that inner signal, which was trying to think of ways of how do you play to your strengths? How do you kind of live your values day to day? What does impact mean for you day to day? And impact for some people is going to be they get paid fortnightly or monthly and get to take a nice holiday and can provide for their family. Impact for other people is going to mean getting out there, taking risks and trying to do things, in my case, to try and help solve for this wicked problem that we call fake news. But I think I've always known that there's these causes that I want to be a part of. And if you can get that blend right, you're starting to fulfill your purpose. you're building these purpose-driven teams, you're part of these purpose-driven companies, and it makes it easier to get up in the morning. It makes it easier also if you know your why. And I constantly have to come back to my why, like, why me, why this, why now? And, well, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? And if not this, well, then what? And so I know every day I have to rise here in a spare room in Drumcondra. We are a remote first company. And I know my why every day, because that sustains me then on the days that are a little bit harder. And it all feels a little bit crazy, and you feel you haven't got a sense of control of the world around you. But if you know your why and that sense of purpose, it means you can always come back to the hows. You can be a little bit flexible and you can take those risks. And so I probably have in my career, sometimes every 3 to 5 years, you know, ask that question, well, what would I do if I weren't afraid? And secondly, what is the worst that can happen? And those are two questions I constantly come back to as a leader. And sometimes the what's the worst can happen, I can live with that. I'm like, yeah, it's a smart bet. I can live with that level at risk. And sometimes I have to dial it back down and go, actually, that's not an acceptable level of risk. What's the plan B or C or D or E or F here? But I think I've intuitively asked myself that question at different stages of my career of, well, what would I do here if I weren't afraid? And the answer has been at times to leave Storyful, a company I loved for 5 years, and to leave Dublin and leave Storyful to go to work for Facebook in New York and become that honest broker between the world's journalists and publishers and try to advocate internally in Facebook for products, tools, services for journalists. And so that's what I would say to other people who are sometimes weighing up those risks in a squiggly career. Our generation is now one where, you know, it's not this stepladder effect, you know, that probably our parents' generation had. It's just this mess. Our generation are predicted to change careers 3 to 5 times on average. And I'm very comfortable with that now. But it does require holding yourself accountable and giving yourself this time. I call it on the balcony, where I literally book time off my calendar every week to reconnect with that sense of purpose and why, and give yourself the energy transfusion to go again next week.
Mm. Well, you've both had experience of being answerable to people in different companies, but you both obviously have very strong entrepreneurial instincts. Maureen, which do you think you are more naturally, the entrepreneur or the person who works well as part of a company?
Oh gosh, I think you know the answer to Tina. No, I'm definitely somebody who is much more into kind of rule breaking, making up my own rules, you know, making things happen. And by whatever form that is, I mean, going back to the BBC, the thing was always, oh, ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Yeah, well, that is actually a great...
Maybe I took it to an extreme. Maybe I took that to extremes of time.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think it's interesting, this idea of leadership. It's a concept. I mean, to be honest, I find it a little bit alien. You know, it's something I've always found it confusing, because there's been such a stereotype of what a leader is. You know, and often it is, even now, it's tied up with being male and, you know, whatever, you know, top of a hierarchical organization. But I think two things. I think, like, in terms of leaders, there've always been women who are leaders. Like, both my great grandmothers, one was a farmer in County Down or whatever, the other was a shopkeeper in Roscommon. They were both leaders. They were both businesswomen. But I'm sure their style, I'm sure they were, you know, they didn't think of themselves in those terms. They just, again, made things kind of happen. You know, so
they,
I think,
got on with it.
They absolutely got on
and
with
tell
it.
Tell me about Tech for Good Dublin.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, yeah, so in terms of Tech for Good, and in terms of what I'm quite interested in at the moment, is this whole idea of kind of Web3 and DAO, which is kind of this whole idea of a distributed, kind of aggregated organization where there isn't a leader. That's what really interests me, to be honest. I don't really want to be a leader. I want to create a network and create a community where basically things happen, and it's very much peer-to-peer. So there's a whole movement at the moment, it's all tying in with cryptocurrencies, around these kind of organizations that are happening where there is, it's completely non-hierarchical. And to me, that's really kind of exciting. It kind of ties in with, gosh, my philosophy studies from years ago, Michel Foucault. And that whole idea was, you know, if something is hierarchical, if there is a leader, if there are, you know, like an American company's president of this or vice president of that, well, they can be very unstable and be very easily toppled. And I've always loved the idea of kind of like ground up, kind of like communities that aren't bound by rules or aren't bound by structures as such. And so Tech for Good is very much like that. You know, it's chaotic, it's ad hoc, it's but we achieve things because there are different people who kind of connect. and people who wouldn't connect otherwise. The whole point of it is harnessing tech for good. So I suppose with tech, there's two sides, isn't it? The way it can be misused and the way it... But the focus here is very much in terms of, well, how can we use it as a powerful tool to make things happen for social good? So that's very much kind of the focus of it. So, for example, over the last 2 weeks since the Russian invasion and war in Ukraine, you know, through social media is amazing. The people you can connect with, you know, suddenly I was connected to somebody from Ukraine living in Ireland. And, you know, within minutes we were kind of planning and WhatsApping each other. And I suppose my role in some ways is kind of a cheerleader or a connector. And through those connections, things happen.
Yeah. From your perspective, do you see the likes of Facebook, Twitter, do you see them as publishers or as platforms? Because that is probably one of the key questions of our time. And Oine, I'll put that to you as well, because in Ireland, at least, our libel laws prevent newspapers from saying very much at all oftentimes. But, you know, there are platforms, inverted commas, that come along that can really spew out information and misinformation, and in doing so create a very powerful wave effect that we spoke about earlier. But ultimately, do you think that the laws around this service, they just need to change? Oine?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we need some other word for the role of platforms in the world today, where they no longer meet that old standard criteria by which we think of being a publisher, you know, because they will argue they're not directly publishing content onto the internet, but facilitating it in a way that is about, you know, freedom of speech, and they're trying to facilitate voices around the world, and therefore not strictly a publisher and therefore a host of the platform. But I think there's probably some third title and definition that we're going to need for increasingly, I suppose, platforms who do blend maybe between being the host of this content and are potentially licensing it. They're now supporting journalism initiatives around the world, as is the case of particularly Facebook, you know, where there are now revenue shares in partnership with the industry. So I think we need a new phrase, a new title. But I think in all of that, it is a given now that we are headed into a world of new regulations for the platforms, that we need new rules of engagement. And be it that the platforms are going to come up with new covenants of understanding in partnership with citizens who use their platforms, and that they're then held accountable to those covenants and those agreements with their users through new oversights and regulations via Brussels or Washington, D.C. But I would like to see, whatever way regulation comes, is that it can be collaborative with experts, independent experts who understand this industry, in collaboration with platforms, in collaboration with citizens-based groups, rather than it primarily and only coming from policymakers in governmental institutions. So I think we're headed into a whole new period in which the question you've just asked is going to be continued to be asked, but I think the answers are going to have to change just as we consider how we are actually going to regulate our codes, our standards on these platforms, and that we really get to grips in a moment like this of learning from January 6th and the riots at the US Capitol, this moment with Ukraine, of how our platforms going to continue to now utilize a playbook where they get to grips very, very quickly with the content on their platforms that can do real world harm very, very quickly.
I won't keep you too much longer, but I wanted to bring in the topic of sexism in the industry, because tech has carved out a reputation for being an industry where women can feel very undervalued. So do you think fundamentally that there is a sexism at play?
I don't think we have enough women creating technology companies, leading those technology companies. And we have to look at the pipeline problem that is there, where we see it very male-led and quite frankly, often lacking diversity more broadly. And the numbers are there to back it up. Something like 94% of VC funding here in Ireland was, you know, for male-founded businesses last year. Now, you do have Enterprise Ireland, of course, are doing a lot of great work at the early stage funding, you know, pre-seed startups led by women, and there's a huge effort there. But I do think we're going to have to look at here in Ireland and other countries of, do we need diversity targets when it comes to VCs investing into technology companies, new startups born here in Ireland, and making sure that we have more female founded businesses coming through in that. Because otherwise what is happening repeatedly is that if you have a lot of startups and technology companies led by men, well, your boardrooms, your directors, your advisors in those rooms tend to be male dominated as well. So it is just constantly circuitous, despite the fact that I do think we have wonderful female entrepreneurs in this country, but I would like to see an awful lot more investment in them. Mm-hmm. And so we can fix that pipeline diversity problem.
Oina Kerr and Maureen Murray, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Now, Maureen is staying with us, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Sarah Geraghty, a senior training consultant with the Communications Clinic, who's joining us today to talk about the art of job preparation and CVs. Sarah, you're very welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks for meeting, Nadine. It's great to be on with you, and Maureen, nice to kind of meet you across the phone line.
And you, Sarah, absolutely.
Now, Sarah, talking CVs, what's a good CV?
It's a great question, Nadine. A great CV is short, it is brief, and I suppose, crucially, it's relevant to the needs of the employer. When I see pitfalls that people face time and time again, and that, you know, can cause great anxiety in people who are, you know, embarking on a job hunting process, what they tend to do is overload the reader, who is the employer in that circumstance, with information that mightn't necessarily be relevant to that employer. So I think the best piece of advice I could give, if anyone is preparing their CV at the moment, is really, before they do anything, is to take out a highlighter or a red pen or whatever they work with best, and highlight forensically the key requirements on a job spec. Because the person reading the CV needs to know within seconds that this person knows what they need, so they can essentially solve their problem. And I know, you know, from speaking to employers time and time again, in fact, I spoke to somebody on this exact conversation, on this exact topic this morning, if they don't get a really good sense quickly that the other person knows what they need and can prove that they can address those needs, they're likely not going to read any further and they're going to pick up somebody else's CV. So I would go prepared with a forensic knowledge of the job spec, of the skills and experiences that are required, and build yourself up with a really strong bank of evidence to show that you have the skills and experiences required for that particular role.
Okay, so individuate your CV. Are you a fan of the picture?
I'm not a fan of the picture, Nadine. Now, I would say, you know, for a lot of this stuff, you know, it can be case by case. I think that a picture, unless it's asked for, can feed into a bias. So unless it's specifically asked of you, I would stay away from sticking a picture onto your CV. The thing I would be looking out for really is that evidence piece. I'd be really looking out for a tailored CV. You know, I think another obstacle a lot of people face is that they think once they've got through the, sometimes what feels like a torturous task in completing the CV, that they're done, you know, that they can fire the same version out to 20 different companies. That's just wrong. You know, you need to prove that you're absolutely crystal clear on that company, what's required for the role, and that you've done the research on the company. So you tailor it according to exactly their needs.
Okay. And if your CV gets you to the interview stage, job interviews these days are very different from maybe how they were in the past. And you can sometimes be doing up to 8 interviews depending on where you apply. But inevitably, people do tend to get asked that same question. What is your biggest weakness? What, in your opinion, is the best way to answer this?
Well, the best way to answer it is probably that, you know, we're probably all thinking of those examples of, you know, well, I'm a perfectionist, or, you know, I like to do things really, really well. And what I'd say about the greatest weakness question is, be honest. You know, don't now either, you know, admit that, you know, you're like me and that you, you know, have a terrible problem with maths and numbers if you're going for an accountancy firm interview, for example. But what you want to do is, you know, address a real legitimate weakness, and indicate to the people asking the question that you've reflected on it. You know, that you've taken measures to address it so that it actually doesn't become a problem or it doesn't get in the way of you doing the best job possible. So, for example, I think of a client recently who said that her greatest weakness was that in the past, she was very anxious or she became really nervous when her manager asked her to speak to a group of more than 5 or 6 people. So what she did is she said, this is a weakness that I've had in the past, but I've taken steps to address it, to make sure that it doesn't hold me back, you know? So she talked about the training she had done. She talked about stepping out of her comfort zone, sticking her hand up to her manager and saying, you know, that if she needed her to step in at any stage for a team meeting, she would do it. But she gave herself more time to prepare, you know? So she really took steps to identify a weakness and reflect on it, and then to make sure that it really didn't get in the way of doing your job. The same way as I know I laugh about the perfectionist answer, but I know there are people who do, you know, describe themselves as perfectionists. This can stand in the way of a role where you're expected to delegate. You know, you can take on the job of 3 or 4 people on your team, which means that you're probably not being as productive or efficient as you could be. So that you need to address that as an issue and, you know, learn how to delegate better and more effectively and ask people on your team to do the job that you probably should be coaching or helping them develop to be able to do. So address the issue and be able to convince the interview panel that you've taken steps to address it so that it doesn't get in the way of you doing your job to the best of your ability.
Should you ask them a question?
You know, I always put that back on the client if I'm working with them. So, I mean, I'm sure we've all heard, you know, examples of crazy questions that people ask at the end of job interviews because somebody told them once that they should ask a question at the end of an interview. And because of that myth, I've heard people ask questions that really don't do them any favours at the end of an interview, such as, how many annual leave days do I get? You know, do you have a casual Friday clothes policy? That kind of stuff. Just ask yourself every time, is the question that I'm going to ask to this panel going to add value to me as a candidate? You know, so maybe try and change your perspective a bit. I don't have to ask a question just for the sake of asking a question. You know, if I've read something in the Business Post, for example, you know, this Sunday about that company, you know, about some kind of new initiative that they're driving, maybe that might be something interesting and real to talk about. But if you don't think that there's something that you've a burning need for the panel to answer in that interview, and it's not something that's going to add value to you, as I say, take the opportunity to, you know, to remind that panel of maybe what you pitched in at the start, you know, that you have, for example, the communications, leadership skills and networking abilities needed to do really well in this job. So take advantage of that, you know, communications reel that people tend to remember the first thing they hear and the last thing they hear. And then when you go out of that interview, you can legitimately pat yourself on the back and say, I ended on a really good note. I got across everything I needed to get across, and that I can move on and do whatever it is I need to do next.
What would you advise in relation to money talk?
What I would advise about that is to really do your research. I know a lot of people tend to go into interviews and they use some version of the because I'm worth it principle. You know, it's like any good negotiation skill or technique. You need to know what you're going in there with. It again goes back to your evidence. What evidence do you have to back up your ask for a certain figure? My main advice is to go do your research about, you know, what the market is offering, so that you're measuring yourself essentially against the market. I would have conversations with people, you know, if there's people in that particular sector, in a particular company doing a specific role, get a good guide or a steer from them. But don't go in there expecting to be reactive and just to pluck a number out of the sky and say, either give me this or I'm walking. Because you need to also be prepared for an offer coming back that isn't the exact figure that you asked for. But if you've done your research, it might enable you to say, okay, well, that's not the exact figure I asked for, but look, can we have a chat about my career trajectory? How often will I have a review meeting? You know, when can I expect to get to that level that I need to get to? So just do your research, talk to people, and remember, you know, that an effective negotiation is about going in there and with your research and I suppose ready not just to slap a figure down and walk away because, you know, that's the figure that that they can offer you, basically.
Women have historically been a little bit less confident about asking for money. Do you think that's changing?
I mean, in terms of the clients that I meet, they encounter males and females needing the same issues, and it's exactly what I just talked about there. You know, that people don't do their research, that they don't ask people, that they don't really do a good job. And I mean this, a lot of these job recruitment processes are jobs in themselves. And this is as important in it, you know, that you're clear on the figure that you're looking for. You have evidence to back it up. I think a lot more people are becoming savvier at communication skills, certainly. So I would say for men and women, that people need to do their research, that they need to make a plan, that they need to, you know, tap into their networks, that they need to know exactly what they're looking for, and they know how to communicate that effectively.
Maureen, to bring you in, listening on to this, is it ringing any bells? Are you thinking of things that you once did or mistakes you might have made?
No, absolutely. That's always a difficult one, isn't it? What's your weakness, or what's your, you know, your biggest weakness? Isn't that the one that they keep asking? It's a really tricky one, and everyone, you know, you always say, "Oh, I'll say I'm a perfectionist," or what was the other one? "Oh, I suffer fools gladly." You know, for me, for example, as when I'm in kind of in a leadership management role, I get carried away with the work, and maybe I'm not communicating enough so that everybody knows my vision. It's something, you know,
yeah,
I learned.
It's a great point, actually. And actually, Sarah, you brought that up as well, just this idea that just saying you're a perfectionist is potentially quite a dangerous thing in terms of, can you multitask? Can you hand work to somebody else and say, look, get on with it? And
Absolutely. Yeah,
detach yourself from some of the finer details of the job in order to get a better macro result. But I won't keep you too much longer. But just one final question. You know, are there any other sort of job hunting tips that you would offer now in this climate of the great resignation, when people are, at least if we believe some of the data coming out of the States, dropping tools and heading out for new planes?
I would say first things first is to look at it as a full-time project, right? Because I think what a lot of people try to do is they try and fit in the job interview, the CV preparation work in between jobs, you know. So I work with people every single day, helping them to get their CVs, cover letters, application forms and interview skills right. And what I really, really would like to impress upon people is that they need to make a plan for themselves. So you need to plan how much time you're going to spend every day preparing to make yourself stand out in the jobs market, you know. And what I'd also add to that, Nadine, is that for loads of different reasons, you know, people are, you know, leaving jobs, you know, whether it was forced upon them or it's just they've decided to make a change. So at some stage, you know, especially in the times we live in, you're going to have to look at that CV again. You're going to have to go back and understand, right, what is it that I have and how do I make this stand out to a time-starved recruiting manager or a panelist, you know, that's going to be snappy and relevant and make it, you know, personal to them from the very start. So what's your pitch for the job? And am I building up a really strong, interesting, colourful bank of evidence that fits in with exactly what they need? And also, look, just making, you know, a kind of a sensible plan as well is understanding, if I'm making a completely, you know, a complete change from one industry to another, what's required of me in this new industry? You know, do I need to go out and do a diploma? Do I need to go out and do a training course? Mm. If that's the case, go and do that. But otherwise, you know, as I said before, tap into your network, talk to people, figure out how to meet new people, and really go back to one of the main principles of good communication, which is understanding your audience and where they're at and meeting them there.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. But Sarah Geraghty, Senior Training Consultant with the Communications Clinic, thank you so much for joining us. And Maureen Murray, Co-Founder of Tech for Good, thank you also.
Thanks, guys.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
And my thanks once again to Maureen Murray, Anya Kerr and Sarah Geraghty. Join us next week for the new How I Did It. And remember, you can find all of our episodes on the Business Post website, businesspost.ie/podcast. And you can also find us on Spotify, iTunes and other podcast providers. Remember, do hit that subscribe button if you are on those providers, as you'll then be informed whenever a new episode drops. This episode of How I Did It was co-produced by myself and Catherine Healy. Right, that's it from me. Till the next time, do take care.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with Nadine O'Regan.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.